And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
A perfectly good brain wasted.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara Counties. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is potpourri. Each of my guests is presenting an interesting topic, no two of which are related. My next guest is an expert on China and is the COO of China Speakers Bureau. She'll discuss China's evolution from her 5 years of living there contained in her book, A Changing China. And if you want to join in the conversation or ask a question, you can call us at 639-0008. That's also the number that we're going to use right now for to win two sandwiches or two salads from Urbane Cafe. I'll give those away to the fourth caller, 639-0008. Urbane Cafe has two locations to service. One here in Ventura is at 4950 Telephone Road in the Barnes & Noble Plaza. The other, 1730 East Gonzales Road, which is the intersection of Gonzales and Rose in Oxnard. I'll give that away to the fourth caller, 639-0008. Call in and win. My next guest, Maria Korolev, is the founder and president of Trombley International, a Massachusetts-based company which runs emerging markets news bureaus for U.S. businesses and trade publications. Trombley International also runs the China Speakers Bureau, which provides China experts to events around the world. Maria was based in Shanghai, China from early 2004 through all of 2008. Interestingly enough, she was born in Leningrad, USSR, back in the old days. Her born name was Maria Viktorovna Corleone. Well, never mind, that sounds Italian, but we'll have her pronounce that for us when she gets on. Maria graduated from Cornell University with a degree in mathematics in 1990. After graduation, she went on to cover Lake County suburbs for the Chicago Tribune. A year later, she went back to Moscow, where she was a freelance war correspondent for UPI, and after several months, she was hired as a reporter by the Moscow Tribune. Maria returned to the United States in 1994, where she moved on to covering another type of revolution, the way the internet was changing the business. Joining us from Western Massachusetts. Hi, Maria. How are you today?
Hi. I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, thank you for being our guest. And I apologize. I could not pronounce your name. What was your born name in Russia? How do you pronounce that correctly?
Back when I was born, my name is Maria Viktorovna Korolyova.
Korolyova. So I wasn't...
Korolyova. It was changed to Korolyova when my parents emigrated to the United States in the 70s.
There you go. Thank you for that correction. And I apologize for butchering it. But let's dive into it, because your expertise is really China. And it intrigues me. China just is fascinating. Now the Middle Kingdom, as it's now known, now has a middle class. And that middle class is ginormous. It's the same size as the population of the United States. Furthermore, by 2025, the middle class is projected to be 800 million people if current trends continue. The same time frame, China will have 200 cities with more than a million residents in each city. So what are the implications of this for American businesses, and how can small business take advantage of this large and growing market?
Well, the implications for American businesses is that everything that we produce that people like internationally, people are also liking, for the most part, in China. So the things that are identified as American, fashion brand names, technology brand names like Apple, media brand names like Hollywood movies, restaurant brand names like KFC. These are things that do really well with the emerging middle class because it makes them feel like they're part of the international community of rich people. And brands can piggyback on this. Smaller brands do that as well by associating themselves with this cachet of being foreign and luxurious and American. So you've got a lot of small colleges marketing themselves to China as New England liberal arts colleges, for example. And you can have regional whiskeys marketing themselves and a lot of other regional companies marketing themselves based on the international recognition of their region's products.
All right, that is good. Now, Maria, in China, if you are one in a million, as the American expression goes, that still means that there are 1,500 more just like you. So what does this burgeoning Chinese middle class mean in terms of the worldwide job market?
It's both a positive and a negative. On the one hand, these people want jobs, and they're willing to do those jobs for lower rates than Americans are. But on the other hand, these people are also buying things, and they're willing to buy things at higher rates than Americans are because they don't have those things yet, like cars, telephones, any kind of consumer goods you might want to imagine. These are all new. They're just forming their brand preferences. They're just investing for the first time in big ticket items. So it goes both ways. In general, having a trading partner that's a rich country is not a bad thing. I mean, we do well when we trade back and forth with Germany. We do well when we trade back and forth with Japan. We used to be worried about the Japanese taking our jobs. But, you know, it doesn't come up much anymore because they're basically just like us, right? So once China grows up to be just like us, I think a lot of those worries are going to go away because for every job that moves to China, that's another consumer with spending power to buy our stuff.
My guest is Maria Korolev, and we're talking about China from her book, A Changing China. But Maria, I want to go back to what you said about Japan. Yes, Japan we no longer fear, although we did fear them dramatically in the 1990s. Yeah. The reason we don't fear them anymore is because they went into a 20-year recession and have yet to recover from that recession. Do you foresee China stopping its phenomenal growth and going into, if not a recession, at least a slower growth period than we've currently seen in the last 5 years?
It will eventually. I mean, the first big jump of growth, where you go from 0 to 10% on the kind of the spending or the GDP scale, that's the big deal. When you don't have a house, and now you have a house. When you don't have a car, now you have a car. When you don't have a purse, and now you have a purse. So you have to build these car factories, these purse factories, underwear factories, house, or, you know, construction industries. But once you have that in place, now you're trading up to a slightly better car. You're trading up to a slightly fancier purse. You're trading up to a nicer brand of underwear. It doesn't take the same kind of growth and retooling for an incremental increase in a product, even if the product costs substantially more. I mean, a $10 purse requires a huge amount of infrastructure to produce. The factories, the transportation networks, the marketing networks, the stores, all that stuff that goes into it. A $1,000 purse doesn't require that much more infrastructure, even though it costs $990 more. And it also doesn't add that much more to your enjoyment of life. It's the incremental improvement. I mean, having a fancy purse instead of a plain purse makes you feel better, but it's still going to carry the same amount of stuff. So the actual productivity of a country is going to level off once the big fundamental requirements of the population are met, and all you're doing after that is doing incremental improvements. So in the United States, in Europe, in Japan, you know, when you're not in a recession, what you've got is you've got incremental improvements in the society, in the consumption culture, in the manufacturing culture, whereas in emerging markets like China, you're having big, substantial, huge revolutionary changes. People moving from subsistence existence in an agricultural sector to a lower middle class existence in a manufacturing sector, get their kids into college, and their kids are having a middle class existence with white collar jobs. And then their kids are going to have an upper middle class existence with creative jobs and lawyers and doctors and artists. So on and so forth. And each transition requires less infrastructure, less building, less manufacturing. But it's, I mean, it's obviously good for the country to make that transition, but it makes less of an impact on the GDP.
All right. My guest is Maria Korolev, and we're talking about her latest book, A Changing China. Maria, before we come back to you, 639-0008 is the number for once two sandwiches or two salads from Urbane Cafe. We've had two callers. Be the fourth caller, and you can win. The telephone number, 639-0008, 639-0008. Now, Maria, back to you. I need you to help explode some commonly held beliefs in the United States about China. And I guess let's start with the first one. Will China be the next Egypt or Libya? Are we going to see a freedom revolution within China anytime soon?
I think if China stops delivering growth, which is what happened in Libya and Egypt, you had a large class of young people who couldn't get jobs because the the growth of the country, the prosperity of the country, wasn't equitably distributed. China's making an extremely concerted effort to invest huge amounts in infrastructure, social infrastructure, roads, schools, creation of manufacturing, blue-collar jobs that help people get on the ladder to prosperity. That's so they're trying hard on the carrot side of it. And they're also trying their best on the stick side of it to keep dissent down to a minimum. So from what I can tell, it seems to be working because the young people are very much optimistic about the future. If that sense of optimism goes, then there's no way to predict what's going to happen.
All right. My guest is Maria Korolev. Maria, let's explode another myth, the myth that China is the U.S.'s banker.
China does have large foreign currency reserves. It's got a lockdown on currency transactions, which is one of the big three problems that China still hasn't addressed from an international business standpoint. But they're buying pieces of paper from us, and in return, they're giving us stuff that we need. And they're getting these pieces of paper from us because they think they're valuable. And I agree with them. You know, if I'm going to invest in any country on the planet, I'm going to invest in the United States. I'm going to bet on the Treasury, as opposed to, say, Greece or some other country.
Well said. The United States still does have a better cachet than Greece, even though our credit rating was downrated to AA+ from AAA for the first time in our U.S. history. All right. My guest is Maria Korolev. Maria, let's explode another myth that China is the global manufacturing powerhouse. That is no longer true. It's changing. Talk to us about the changing manufacturing scene in China right now.
It's changing, I think, to China plus one, where you have a manufacturing facility in China, but you also have a manufacturing facility somewhere else. There's lots of emerging countries. And so if you're a really, really big multinational, you want to hedge your bets. You want to have you don't want to have all your eggs in one basket. What if something happens? What if the labor laws change? Or there's a problem with exporting items from China to the United States because of tariffs or a trade war, or who knows what's going to happen.
Or a regime change.
Or a regime change, yes. And then the other thing that's happening is that because transportation costs money, oversight costs money, management costs money, it costs money to make sure that all the mistakes are fixed, that the quality standards are maintained. And when you add in all these costs, sometimes it actually makes sense to move manufacturing back to the United States. You're closer to the customer. You can keep a closer eye on quality. You can have a faster turnaround cycle for your manufacturing, get to market faster. And as wages in China increase, and benefits increase, and government mandated standards increase, you're going to have more and more parity in terms of where you want to manufacture things. And this is why Japanese companies move their plants to the United States. You want to be close to the customer. You want the plants to be faster, more efficient. And the same thing is happening with Chinese manufacturing as well.
All right. My guest is Maria Korolev. She is the author of a book, A Changing China. And Maria, it's been 21 years since Tiananmen Square in China. The population is growing, as you know, in China. But my question to you is this. Will the communist government be able to deal with all of the industrial and urban problems? Or are we going to see the Chinese government move towards democracy anytime? And the reason that I ask this is because just 2 weeks ago, there was in September, there was the major train wreck in China of their high-speed rail train. And then just 2 weeks ago, the Chinese government brought in bulldozers and literally buried the train wreck so as to hide their embarrassment. Will we see the communist government be able to deal with industrial and urban problems as the country continues to modernize?
I think there's a good chance that they will. There are several Asian countries that made the same kind of transition from totalitarian regimes to democratic regimes, and usually involve generational shifts. And I think that there's a good chance that the same thing can happen in China, where the government slowly opens up democratic processes, makes things more transparent. You have the rise of social media helping with the communication flows. It's going to be, you know, one step forward, two steps back for a long time, as, you know, any kind of progress is. But as the kids of the existing power brokers and leaders go into business, and the future of families is in the economic prosperity, not in political power, it will become easier for people to give up their hold on power. So if you're a dictator in some little tin pot dictatorship somewhere, and you lose power, your kids are going to be thrown into jail or executed or forced to go into exile for the rest of their lives. And whereas if your kids are going into business and you lose an election, the kids will continue to have their business interests, especially if they've diversified their local and international business interests. There's a future for the next generation without having to maintain a totalitarian regime. And I think that's happening in China, and I think it bodes extremely well for the future, that both for the leaders and for the country as a whole, the end goal is economic prosperity, not hold on to power at all costs.
Boy, and I hope that you're right. My guest is Maria Korolev, author of the book, A Changing China. Maria, what do you want readers to take away from reading your book, A Changing China?
From my perspective, I think the main takeaway is that people really are the same everywhere. I had staff working for me in China, and I had staff working for me in Russia, and I had staff working for me in the United States. And what I find is that the basic things that motivate people aren't that different anywhere, and that people aren't... They're not like these mysterious Asian mentality that they value their parents and believe in tradition and all this other stuff. I mean, we Americans, we value our parents, we believe in tradition, but we have Social Security to take care of our parents. They don't have Social Security in China yet. Once they do, the whole, you know, the fixed idea that you have to take care of your parents at all costs, it won't be as important to people because there will be a social safety net. So these kinds of things, I think, happen very quickly, and you can see them happen in immigrant families. Once they come to the United States and are living in a different economic situation, their behaviors changes, their attitude changes really quickly. And it's happening in China as people move from the country to the city. Their economic perspective changes, their hopes for the future change, their options change, and their behaviors change very quickly as well, to the point that the people who live in rural China have more in common with, say, our grandparents than they do with their neighbors in the cities.
All right. My guest has been Maria Korolev, author of the book, A Changing China. Maria, if people want to learn more about you, learn more about your book, where would you direct them to go on the Internet?
Well, you can look up A Changing China on Amazon. And it's listed under my maiden name, Trombley. That's not my maiden name, my married name, T-R-O-M-B-L-Y. And you can also go to our website, china-speakers-bureau.com.
China-speakers-bureau.com. Maria, thank you so much for being my guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Well, I had fun being here. Thank you so much for having me on.
And thank you.